Welcome to the latest Nostalgia interview. My name is Chris Deasy and Vivian Asimos is my guest this week. We talk about her PhD on video games. We find out what Slender Man is really all about. We talk about the line between fiction and reality. We talk about growing up in Florida and now being based in Durham. We talk about creative writing, stumbling into religious studies, the narrative dimension of her PhD, what, if anything, she remembers from childhood, playing piano, funk, listening to the charts on her way to church, the relationship between music and identity. We talk about Delda Shant. We talk about Lord of the Rings, working in a food bank and other charity work, working on Obama's re-election campaign, why politics is especially angry right now, what students protested against when she was a student, why she had better not go to places where elections are taking place, the influence of mixtapes and burning CDs in pre-streaming days, how she got into podcasts through radio, whether Vivian's memories are mainly positive, how we need bad things to appreciate when good things are happening, whether she fulfilled the dreams she had when she was young, what her childhood version of herself would expect she would be doing now, why the PhD was a stepping rather than an endpoint, and how she uses the past as a learning experience for future situations. So join me as I interview Vivian Asimos in the latest of my nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is an absolute pleasure here in Durham to interview Vivian Asimos.
Yes.
And, of course, you interviewed me about 18 months ago.
Has it been that long?
Yeah. And you came down to Kent. So this is almost like a taste of your own medicine now. The boot's on the other foot. And fairly recently, of course, you got your PhD.
I did. Yeah. Thank you.
And your PhD was in video games, very generally.
Yeah, so it was mostly focusing on virtual storytelling, is how I put it, because it focuses on online stuff, video games, web videos, all sorts of different online virtual content.
Yeah, and so whenever then I see that there's a film adaptation of a video game, it's often something that you've given a talk about at conferences. Is it the Slender Man?
Yes, yeah. That's my main case study that I was working with.
And who was Slender Man?
He's a very tall monster that looks like a man wearing a suit, and he makes children disappear and kills people in very brutal ways.
So a sort of intersection with the horror.
Yes, it was a very fun couple of years.
Because I think it came out in the cinema. Was there a Slender Man film adaptation?
There was, It didn't come out quite enough time for me to use it in my PhD itself, but yeah.
Yeah. So, no, and it was, I think, very limited showings where I live, and I think they all tended to be quite late at night, which maybe is quite appropriate considering.
Well, there was also quite limitations because of, there were a couple of court cases and stabbings and stuff like that were attributed to this idea. Yeah. So a lot of movie theaters were forbidding the showing, but that's a whole other conversation.
Because I can remember when Candyman came out. It was many years. It came out in 1992. Many years later, I saw it, but I think that was very similar. That it was, you know, people were watching it, and there were maybe not copycat acts, but certainly the film was kind of bridging the gap between reality and fiction. I think some people were a bit sort of quite spooked out by it, and it kind of entered folklore pretty. Within just a few years of the film, it really developed cult status.
Yeah, the whole nature of particularly the horror storytelling online, they seek to kind of blur those reality fiction, but that's kind of part of the medium. And I think some people see that as a very terrible thing, but for a lot of these people, it's actually a very positive thing. That's what I was trying to show in my PhD, is that it's not all bad.
And tell me a bit about your own background, so in terms of where and when you were born.
Well, if you could tell by my accent, I am American.
not from County Durham.
No, I am not. I get that a lot when I get on. I was on a bus in Leeds, and someone asked me where I was from, and I said, I'm from Durham. And they said, oh, you don't sound like you're from Durham. And I was I live there now. I'm originally from America. I was born in Florida. lived there for 18 years. No, more than that, 21. And then I moved to the UK. So I lived in the north of Florida, which is the part of Florida that thinks it's southern Georgia. So it's very rednecky, very southern culture. And the further south you go in Florida, the more north you get, culturally speaking. Yeah. So it's, I went further north.
So is that the Tallahassee part? That's the
yeah, it's up there. Yeah. I grew up around Jacksonville, which is on the coast more. Yeah, it's got a very high crime rate. It's a really wonderful place.
but it's funny, though, isn't it? Because when you associate, you know, I mean, I've been at Kent since 2004. And so when people ask where I'm from, it's an interesting question because I'm Welsh originally. And I spent I was 31 when I actually left Wales and worked in England. But now I've got children who are going through the school system within the county of Kent. And it is interesting because that question of identity and where you are, and of course in your case you've obviously experienced very different educational systems. So I guess that question of who you are, where you're from, I guess you just have to sometimes stop and think of the answer that you need to give.
Yeah, I give different, depending on how the question is worded, I give different answers. Some people say, where were you from originally? And that's when I'll start saying Florida. But if they just kind of generally ask, I say Durham because that's, you know, I've been living here for 3-4 years. My partner's here. We have a house together. It feels like a very rooted place. So whenever I travel somewhere else, say when I was in Leeds, and they ask where I'm from, I go, well, I live in Durham. That's where I have traveled from to get here. But yeah, it's my biggest surprise with the different educational systems when I first went to the UK, because so I did my undergrad in Florida. And in America, in the religion departments, it's all religious studies. There's no theology. Theology is not at universities. And I didn't even think about the fact that it might be different until I was in the UK. And there was suddenly this, in Edinburgh especially, there was this huge Cold War happening between religious studies and theology in the department. And I was going, what is happening? I'm not used to this.
Well, no, and when I was at Lampeter, there, when we all moved into a new building where there were 3 or 4 floors, it was clear that the theologians were on one floor, the religious studies on the other, and that actually, unfortunately, I think, cemented that idea that we were at loggerheads with each other.
Yeah.
The idea that we would be compartmentalised and sort of certain people would never then need to, you know, traipse on a certain corridor because the people there were of a different, you know, disciplinary species.
I've been on a quite intellectual roller coaster with my idea of theology, because obviously in America it's associated a lot with seminaries and with training of priests, and so it's got that flavor to it. Well, it's not quite that way here, but when I first came here, that's what I kind of associated with it. Well, everyone in theology wants to be a priest, and that's what they're doing, and it's not that they're just historians that are happening to read the Bible, you know. So I'm much more open now to theologians than I was in the past.
Yeah, but it's true that sometimes the answer that you give depends on who's asking the question, because sometimes they are loaded questions. And, you know, I've had it even not just in academia, but in fast food restaurants, or somebody will be asking, like, you know, so do you believe in God, or what's your reason for studying this? And, you know, it turns out they may be a pastor in a local church or something. And so they have a reason for asking. But you know, all questions are tactical. And I think that it's particularly acute in this subject area, in theology and religious studies, but also in terms of what you were just saying about where you're from, it also says something about this profession, because there is so much moving around. You know, it's quite normal in any university to have people from all sorts of different countries and continents in a way that might not happen to the same degree in many other professions. So it seems really odd that you might travel from one country to another in order to embark on a course of study. But that's what we do. That's what the jobs might be.
Yeah, it's been very interesting, I think, to just the whole, especially moving to another country and getting it. It feels like there's a lot of similarities between the UK and the US, so it doesn't feel like it'd be as huge of a, say, culture change as it would be if I was in a completely different country. But I think those small things is what really impacts you the most, more than the big things, because you expect big things to be different.
Yeah.
But
yeah, and in terms of what your parents did, I mean, have you followed a very different sort of route to them?
Yes and no. So both of my parents are very education forward people. So my dad actually went to university on a baseball scholarship, but he always tells me this story about how he was So they had like a specific academic advisor that would help you pick courses for the athletes. And they were trying to advise him to not take certain courses because they were considered harder courses. But he was like, well, that's part of my degree program and I want to do this. And so, you know, him kind of trying to fight that stereotype, which I thought was really interesting. But he did history, specializing in the Soviet Union, which has proved very useful. And my mother also did a lot more of a history focus and stuff. But she has a little bit of a slant towards studying religion, and she did that more on her own spare time. I think I'm kind of following what my mother would have done had she not had children and gotten married and that kind of a thing. So that's why it's like yes and no.
It's interesting, isn't it, how sometimes even if we do quite different things or what appear to be very different things to our parents, often we can look back and think actually that the sort of commitment or the sort of attitude that you take to a particular job is very much the same.
Yeah.
And I can see so much of myself in my parents, but I followed a very different career path to them because more than anything else, opportunities, you know, generational, you know, my sister and I were first generation university. But it's funny then to sort of look back and say actually, without realising it at the time, you know, that these, you know, yes, maybe they would have done the same thing if they'd had the same opportunities.
Yeah, and I always think that intelligence and being smart is very different from education.
Yeah.
There are many people that I know who dropped out of high school who are smarter than some of the people I know who have PhDs, you know?
Well, you must have this as well. You know, when I was doing the PhD, people would say, oh, you're obviously a very clever person. But I think, well, actually, it's more than that because, you know, there are people who win quizzes, or like there was a case of a London cab driver who won Mastermind in the 80s, and he was like, he knew the answer to every question. But of course, that's real, you know, cleverness. But doing a PhD is a very different sort of skill.
It's work ethic more than anything.
It is. You need to assimilate material. You need to go and find sources and assimilate them. And it is not the same as being clever in the sense it's being diligent.
Yeah.
And it's being creative, but it's also being methodical. And I think that sometimes the assumption is that the higher you reach in education, it says something about how intelligent you are. Well, to an extent, that's part of it. But it's not the only picture.
I used to say whenever someone would say, like, oh, you must be really smart, then I used to say, oh, I just have nothing else to do with my time, which was essentially true because I started doing a master's because I didn't know what else I wanted to do with my life. So I was like, well, and then, you know, the only reason to get a master's in religious studies is to get a PhD in religious studies. So, you know, why not?
Yeah. But it's often those fortuitous routes and sometimes the unexpected routes that we take where we might have thought, you know, in my case, my dad worked on the railway. So of course, when I was really young, I thought, oh, I want to be a train driver. But, you know, but it's really funny and I suppose I had a real interest in radio when I was young and I haven't quite, you know, I took a different route, but now I seem somehow to be coming back to that passion through the podcast.
With the microphone between us.
Yeah. So it's funny that sometimes I'm a big believer that, and it'll be one of my later questions, but I'm a big believer that sometimes you never quite give up on those childhood dreams, and you might not do exactly what you thought you can do at the age of 5 or 15, but as opportunities and technologies change, sometimes you adapt to that, and somehow you end up, hopefully sometimes, saying, you know, I'm actually closer to what I was doing now than I thought might have been the case when I left university.
I wanted to be a writer. I did creative writing. And I was one of those people who I knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't have the fanciful other things constantly changing throughout. I wanted to be a writer. That was what I wanted to do. I went to university to do creative writing. And I stumbled into religious studies. So I ended up finishing with both a BA in both religious studies and creative writing. And I thought for a really long time that I dropped the creative writing aspect and I was just doing this academic stuff and studying religion. But then when I had finished my PhD, I had this very kind of narrative beginning and a very narrative ending. Yeah. And my examiners had actually commented on the way that it flowed and the way it was written. And I went, oh, maybe I haven't dropped it entirely. It's still there. And it might be there in a much better way than it was before.
Yeah. So it's interesting, isn't it, that sort of need for, is it openness or closure? Because you mentioned the narrative endings, but it's as though, like, when you, I mean, obviously you've only just finished the PhD, but in a way you sort of finish one narrative, but the other one, I'm guessing, whatever that might be, maybe you don't know yet, but it's starting to, you know, in other words, you finish one narrative and the next one starts. The idea that you say, right, I've done this now, that's it, I walk away, you know, inevitably the body, the mind is really sometimes saying, well, okay, you've done that. Well, we need to find something to fill that space.
Yeah.
So do you feel at the moment that's where you are? Do you feel that you've got some great ambitions for further study or something else?
I know what I want to study next, and I know what I want to research next, and it's just a matter of whether or not I get given the opportunity to do it. But I've already decided that even if I can't get a job in academia to do that, I'm going to do it anyway, and I'll just do the research on my own and publish it as a nonfiction book, and maybe then I won't have quite the same restraints as like an academic publishing would have on it. But I'm going to do it anyway and write it anyway.
Well, I think that's brilliant because, I mean, I think it struck me a few years ago that really, and perhaps before I even started using social media, that people really only knew me through outside of my immediate sort of circle of students and colleagues and family. People only knew me through my research publications. And I thought, you know, if there was one word that was ever going to define me, if it was my legacy, I would feel uncomfortable with it being theologian. Maybe academic, because there's a lot of the time I spend with students, you know, as senior tutor. So the content of my subject is important, but it's not all that I do. So, yeah, so sometimes I think when you look at it that way, I think, you know, I write diaries and I do sort of film reviews. And I think there are lots of things I do, but the idea that you could pigeonhole me in one way and say that's what he does. So I kind of feel that whatever I do in the future, probably something related to the diaries, there will need to be some form of dissemination. And that will feel more authentically me. And people, there might be some people who will say, oh my goodness, you know, I just thought all he did was write about film and Christmas.
Well, there is something, because like, there's a part of me that always finds something really interesting and I want to show the world this thing that's really interesting, but I'm not going to analyze it or anything like that. And so there is some amount of fun that would be had with doing something non-academic with it, of just saying, basically writing a thing, just saying, here, look at this, and that's it. And I'm not going to do anything else to it. I'm not going to pick it apart. I'm just going to show you that this thing is here, and isn't that cool?
Yeah. Well, in a way, I think you could say that you've earned your stripes, as the saying goes. You know, you've sort of shown that you can do that side of things. So why not branch out into something else creative in a different way, a different set of skills?
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
But going back a long, long way, what about earliest memories? How far can you go back? What can you remember from childhood?
Not very much. I am one of those people that will immediately forget things. Yeah. And like my partner the other day was talking about how he had this memory from when he was five. And I'm like, I don't think I remember anything from when I was five. My earliest memory is probably actually quite young, but there's lots of gaps after that, which is when my parents first told me that they were going to get a divorce. And it's a very short memory. And I don't remember the words or anything like that. I just remember laying on top of my dad and my sister had paused a video game and I was watching the pause screen of the video game. And that's all I remember from that little bit. And then the next one's not until I was like 13 or 14 or
something. Yeah. No, it's interesting because when I ask that question, some people have very clear memories from a ridiculously young age. And you say others a bit more sort of, well, the odd thing comes, you know, seeps in and out of consciousness.
Yeah.
But it's a bit of a blur.
It's a bit more of a blur. And I remember some visual things, but I mostly remember audio stuff more than I'll remember visual. I'm not a very visual person.
Yeah. What about things that you enjoyed doing as a child? I mean, can you remember whether it's sort of like dance or sport or music? You mentioned auditory things.
It was always music.
Yeah.
So my parents did this thing when we were really young where we all had to do 1 year of sport, we had to do 1 year of ballet, and we had to do 1 year of piano. Mm. And I stuck with piano. And I played piano up until I basically left and didn't have a piano in my house anymore as a young adult at university. And I still would like to go back and keep playing, but I'm probably not as good as I used to be. But I love music, and to me music is, you know, when I'm in a certain mood, that's the type of music I'll listen to. And I don't have like, oh, that's the genre I like. There's a couple of genres I don't like, but other than that, I'll listen to literally anything. I've been listening to funk recently because why not, I guess.
Yeah. But is that in some way like a continuation of maybe musical styles that interested you when you were younger? I mean, do you sort of feel that there's a continuity? I mean, like for me, there's this huge, this weird, you know, it's almost, I listen to exactly the same music that I grew up with, in the sense that in some cases I literally recorded them when I was young and I digitized the tapes. Or I love listening to those nostalgia radio programs and I think, oh, I remember that from, you know, 35 years ago or whatever it might be.
I remember my dad liked Simon and Garfunkel, but he also liked The Who and the Cranberries. So it's like a very eclectic, I think, taste from him. But I remember listening to Simon and Garfunkel with him, and I do like that kind of folksy take sometimes. But I got really into jazz music at a very young age, and my grandmother actually kind of made some comment once to me about how she thought it was weird that I was listening to Billie Holiday, yeah. And that was, she's like, oh, it was before my time. And I'm like, yeah. Well, it's still good. Like, it doesn't matter what time it's from. I don't think either of my parents really listened to jazz. That was more of something that I picked up, I mean, quite young. And then I ended up being in a jazz band for a while. And there's still, what I like about funk is that slight jazz twist, and anything that's got a little bit of a jazz or swing to it is something that I'll gravitate towards anytime.
Yeah. And what about things like the charts? I mean, do you remember sort of what the contemporary songs were when you were growing up?
I used to listen to the top, like, I can't remember what the number was, like 50 or 100 or something, and it would play every Sunday. And we would listen to it, like the beginning of it on our way to church when my dad used to drag us to church. It didn't last very long. And then we would listen to the last bits of it when we would be coming home. And it was like when like my funk soul brother, I don't remember the name of it, but like that kind of stuff was on the radio. But I remember listening to those. I still listen to pop every so often. But I primarily listen to like people changing pop into other kind of forms because that's always really fun. I've always almost more angry at myself when I really like a pop song.
It's funny what you said about Sundays, because I've got this memory of, it's almost as though, maybe it's the analogy now with like work by day, cinema by evening, but church on a Sunday morning, I'd serve in my local Anglican church, and then at 5 o'clock, writing down the top 40 every week. And it was almost as though the two, one played off the other. Like, because I'd been to church in the morning, I could indulge with the charts at 5 o'clock. And it was so exciting, you know, because in those days, it wasn't social media. You know, if you wanted to know what was number one, even the music industry, you know, they would find out at the same time, at 6:55 when it would be unveiled on national radio.
I mean, when I was a kid, that's how it was. And there was, I remembered watching essentially the deterioration of the radio's ability to tell you what the top 40 are. Yeah. And now how there really isn't top 40, it's just whatever's streaming on Spotify the most.
The boundaries keep changing in terms of, it's not record, you know, obviously record sales. I mean, we don't have really records that would be, vinyls come back, but of course we have streaming. You know, there's a whole, it was once upon a time, it was literally who bought the 7-inch vinyls from shops like HMV and Woolworths.
I was listening to a YouTube video recently that was talking about how there's now, so for a while it was also the singles that would reign. And so you would, even when, you know, it was starting to deteriorate and stuff, they would still release a single and they'd release it on Spotify and on all that stuff. And then that would kind of reign. And now it's becoming albums rather than singles, which is making it a lot harder for you to just listen to one song and really get it. And it's interesting kind of watching that flow. And it happens so fast that you can really, you know, and I'm not that old, but I'm a little old, but I'm not that old. But I can see the tracking of just watching it slowly change.
No, well, it's funny, as you were talking, I'm not asking you to answer this question, but it certainly sounded as though your parents are clearly a lot closer to my age, and so therefore when you were talking about what they were interested in, your grandmother, it's a generation out. I find that really fascinating, that you know, the musical interests that you grew up with are a complete sort of generation out from my own experience.
I mean, it depends on the, because I don't remember much of what my dad would listen to. He wasn't as into music. My mom would listen to all sorts of weird things, but she grew up in Hawaii, so she also had lots of like Hawaiian music that would play, which was always really weird for, I think, anyone else that would come by. And then there was like, you know, a ukulele playing in the corner, you know, and that's just, but my mom's weird in a lot of other ways as well. But, music was mostly between me and my sisters.
Yeah.
Like, we all played music. They did band up in high school. I was seen as the traitor because I didn't do band in high school.
So it was actually literally playing music rather than
just, we would play music. We'd hear music together. We'd play music together. I used to play the piano and my sister would sing. And then I would do harmonies with her and that kind of stuff. And my mom would always be really jealous because she can't play music at all. But so like for me, music was always the thing that I had with my sisters more than what I had with my parents or with any other family member. It was what me and my sisters all did together. Yeah. And we'd be able to listen to a song and my sister would be able to know what time signature it was in. And, you know, she used to be basically the conductor for the band. And so she'd be able to, she'd practice by conducting to like pop music and stuff like that.
And does that still go on now, in the sense of, do you have the same sort of interest? Are those dynamics sort of replicated now in adulthood?
Yeah, me, me and one of my sisters definitely have the same. I still occasionally send her clips of things. Me and her really like a cappella group, so I'll send her like, oh, this is a really good a cappella group, and she'll know about the dynamics of it and that kind of stuff. I don't talk to one of my other sisters as much about music, but that's kind of where we tend to not disagree a lot, is when it comes to music and liking music. And orchestral scores were things that we could listen to with each other. So one of the things, we used to watch Lord of the Rings, because I'm a giant nerd and still am, but the thing that we loved the most about Lord of the Rings was the soundtrack. So, yeah, that was...
But very sort of Celtic. Annie Lennox, I think, was involved.
Yeah, Annie Lennox did one of them. There was this... I still say that my soul resides in this one chord in the song The Breaking of the Fellowship from the first movie. There's this violins come in, and it's a very long one note, and then everyone joins in one chord, and it's just the most beautiful moment. And that's just, if I could live in that moment, that sound moment, that's what I would do.
Yeah, and I think that's what... I mean, I said a moment ago that, you know, I still listen to the same music from, you know, 35 years ago growing up. But I think that's the whole point. It's not about whether the music's good or not. Those were the sounds of a particular era.
Yeah.
And all my memories, all my experiences, the conversations I had in the school playground revolved around those particular sounds. So it's utterly in my DNA. And so that's why sometimes somebody might dismiss something and I think, well, hang on a minute, you know, actually that is just like, that encapsulates, you know, June 1982 or whatever it might be. And it's like, you know, that's my 9th birthday there. So, you know, if you trash that song, you know, what you're really saying is, you know, somehow that particular era is inconsequential or I need to revisit it because it was trash. But it is funny though that music and identity have an unbelievable hold on people and generationally as well. When you mentioned about the, you know, your family, people who sometimes come from a musical family, and maybe there's one sibling who isn't musical, and they, you know, they're really made to feel the sort of, you know, you're the black sheep in the family.
I mean, I still play music. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's hard to be in a marching band when you play piano. You know, it's like there's only so much I can do. But I mean, I still played music at home, and again, like that was during the time I wasn't in band, but my sister would still stand by the piano, and we'd sing Adele songs while I played it on the piano, and you know, that was what we did.
I think you must be 40 years younger than me. You know, I was sort of like Bucks Fizz and Shaking Stevens, don't I? But how did you end up entering this profession? What made you go into... I mean, in a way, you've sort of answered this because you said about what happened with the MA, but how did you end up in academia?
Half a joke, but So I stumbled into religious studies specifically. So in America, you have to take certain foundational classes. So you have to fill in so many humanities, so many sciences or whatever. And one of the ones that ticked the box was... It took two boxes, actually, was Intro to World Religions. So I took it because it ticked two boxes and I loved it. So I was going to finish my undergrad very early, but I had funding for 4 years. So I was trying to find ways to extend it by taking all sorts of like classes that had nothing to do with my degree. So I signed up for another religion course it was my fun class. Yeah. Instead of taking like underwater basket weaving, I was taking intro to new religious movements and things like that. But I loved it and I kept taking them and I kept taking them until finally I was like, well, I can just do this. But it went very quickly from I'll just sign up and get the degree because I might as well at this point to I really love this and I want to keep doing this. And one class changed that for me was I signed up for an independent research one. So it was just me and a lecturer and we organized when we would meet and he gave me certain things to read and I'd write certain papers on it. And I really enjoyed it and I was having so much fun. It was like the one class that I spent the most time on because I wanted to more than because I needed to. And I remember having a conversation with my mom about it, and she said, oh, it just sounds like grad school, what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so I went, okay, well, maybe I'll do a master's then. And so I ended up trying to go for a master's in new religious movements, because that's what I was working on at the time. But then over the summer, I started seeing that no one was looking at popular culture the way that I wanted them to look at popular culture. And so by the time I arrived in Scotland, I knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah. No, that evolution is really important because sometimes we surprise ourselves as to how we're both in need sometimes of sort of responding to our own educational heritage. In other words, you know, we do a degree in a certain area, we think in a certain way. But at the same time, we then want to cultivate research areas because it comes down to that question, what makes you get up at whatever time in the morning and work on a project? If you wake up in the morning and think, I don't want to be doing this, then it shows that it's not the right project to be working on. And I think that's really interesting that sometimes you say, you know, even if I didn't get funded to do this PhD or write the book that you were talking about, you're going to do it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel about the PhD. I'm not funded. It was just one of those where I'm like, I'm going to do this, and my research was too weird to get funding. So luckily, the United States allows you to take out lots of loans. Yeah. So that's what I did. And I was like, because it was that idea of I'm going to do this no matter what, and it makes me happy, and why not?
Yeah. Were there particular teachers who inspired you, either in high school or indeed at university? Because I'm assuming that you went to Florida to do your
first degree. Yeah, I went to the University of South Florida, which was in Tampa. And it was one of those departments that had really amazing people and no funding. I mean, which is, as I realized later, most religion departments. But at the time, it was so like awe-inspiring to see these people. There was there were two in particular. One who was very angry that I ended up not going into biblical studies because he's taught Hebrew Bible. He was this cynical Jew. Paul Schneider, I think was his name, but he was this very cynical Jew teaching about the New Testament, and it was just like the best kind of class you could take is when you have that, and he would make commentary about what preachers might say about this, but this is actually what it is historically, you know, that kind of a thing. So he was just really fun, and he would title courses off of pop culture, which made things really fun for me. And I did a whole independent class with him researching dragons in the Bible because I'm a nerd again. And it was fun. But the big one to me was Del DeShant, who was there as well.
Yes, I know his work on Christmas, the sacred.
Yes, he did. Yeah. He did a book on Santa Claus, and he's done a lot of research on new religious movements. And that's really that's why I was doing new religious movements, was because of him. And that's what I wanted to focus on. And it was all because of him. And I was studying Christian Science in particular because of him. And that's what he did a lot. And he was such a friendly man, and he saw potential in everyone. And I'd signed up for two classes, and within those two classes, he had already really inspired me. He's the one that taught Intro to World Religions, and he was just so, and you could see how much he loved what he was doing when he was teaching, and I wanted that. I wanted to be that excited about something.
No, and his work was groundbreaking. The Sacred Santa. I always thought that actually, because his name is Del DeShant, I was convinced that there was an acronym there somewhere, because Sacred Santa Del DeShant. If you move the letters around, I'm pretty sure I could be wrong on that, but it always felt that it should be. But he did some wonderful work looking at ancient cosmology, and then the modern cosmology of, you know, ancient temples and modern shopping malls, and say how Christmas is the ritual of the 21st century, the postmodern.
Yeah. He did a talk cosmology when I was there, you know, just for students to come in about Santa Claus and Christmas. And I went because it was fun, and I was supporting, you know, my professor. And then I was like, this is fascinating, you know. Yeah. He was just one of those people. And everything that he did with passion. And
Are you still in touch with him?
Not really. Yeah. I send him a message every once in a while. He wrote me a very good reference for when I went to Edinburgh, and he was very excited about me going there. I was going because I wanted to work with Stephen Sutcliffe, because he did research on new religious movements. And I was, you know, oh, I should do something for you to thank you. And he just said, oh, just give me a shirt. Yeah. So I sent him an Edinburgh shirt, and then when I went to Durham, I sent him a Durham shirt. And so I sent him just a quick letter in the mail. He does everything very old school. He mailed my reference letter to Edinburgh. I love him, but so yeah, I sent him a letter just saying that I was almost finished with my PhD, but I haven't sent him anything since. So I was waiting till I got a job, and then I could tell him that.
But if you are in touch with him, he's probably the most cited author in my Christmas book for obvious reasons, because he sort of pioneered that area. It made it respectable and acceptable to study this intersection.
He'd be happy to hear that.
Yeah. So no. Well, after we finish recording, we'll.
I'll send him a link. I'm sure.
Well, or you might have to do something very old school. So maybe a stamped address envelope.
Yes.
What about other things when you're at university? Music, film. I mean, so film is sort of an interest of yours. Am I right in thinking that, or is it
yes
more
and
sort
no.
of more because of the video connection?
I'm not really that into film. I was never really a film person. I'm never in a mood to see a movie. You know, I have started trying to get better because my partner wants to see films, and every time he'd be like, do you want to go see a movie, and I'd be like, no. But we now do movie night every Friday, so every Friday we watch a movie. But yeah, I was never much of a film person. I did watch more of like the nerd, some nerd films. I'm probably behind what a lot of other people would think that I should be at. But, you know, I watched Lord of the Rings, but I also had read Lord of the Rings. So, you know, there was a little bit of that. I was much more into music, but that was more on my own time. I didn't really get too involved, but I did a lot of more, I was a member of a fraternity, which sounds really weird, but I was. But it was all not customer service. We did service for people and helped out at food banks and that kind of stuff was more of what I did. Just kind of helping people and doing things and listening to music during that time.
So doing some really, you know, volunteer work, charity
work? Yeah, lots of charity work, lots of volunteer. We work at a food bank. We worked at, there was this one place in Tampa. It's a really amazing place. If anyone gets a chance to go, it's really good. It's called Big Cat Rescue. And what they'll go and they'll take tigers and stuff from people who like own them personally as like pets and save them and basically rescue them, but then they obviously can't be released back into the wild, so they try to make it as natural to them as humanly possible without it being a release. But you can basically, their way of getting money is you can go around and see tigers in these captivities and
stuff. That's amazing, because I had one undergraduate she graduated 2 or 3 years ago, and she was always spending her weekends at railway stations with money boxes. You know, she was collecting money for really good causes, and it was such a passion. I mean, this was a life for her, and I used to teach her. We had a seminar Friday afternoon, and she'd always be wearing, because it was sort of straight after the lecture, she was going off on a journey somewhere, so she could collect money somewhere, you know, the other side of the country. It wasn't a local thing, and it was so impressive, and it was clear that, you know, she was so conscientious, so committed, she was a good student. But, you know, it really, you know, for her, that she, important though academic study was, it meant so much that she was able to do this sort of volunteer work. And it was just like, it made me feel bad, because when I was at university, you know, I'd be writing down the charts or something, you know what I mean? It's utter self-indulgence.
I regret not doing more since starting to do postgraduate work. But I mean, for me, I only applied to the University of Edinburgh for my master's, and I figured if I don't get into that, it wasn't meant to be. And I was interning as a grant writer, so I would write it was a particular charity I was working for. It was for them to get money from different organizations in order for them to keep doing their charity work. So that's what I was doing, and I was actually in the middle of trying to get them funding in order to set up a free clinic in Tampa, when I then had to be like, oh, I just got accepted at Edinburgh, and I have to leave for Scotland. But that was my backup plan, was that's what I was going to do.
Are you still in touch with some of those same folks?
No, I'm not. The guy was really nice. He was essentially my boss. It didn't really quite feel like a boss thing. It was more of like a mentor, I guess, kind of a thing. But no, I'm not. I'm still in touch with the fraternity slightly, and what they're doing and what they're up to, but not as much as I'd like. I've kind of been meaning to do more here, but it's hard to find time, and I know that's a really bad excuse because I probably would have felt that way during my undergrad.
But what about other things that were going on? I mean, politics. I mean, as soon as you mentioned Florida, I can't not think about what happened in 2000, of course, and the ballot.
Yes.
Because it was so divisive, and you know, those hanging chads. I mean, you were probably, I'm guessing you were very young at the time, but growing up in Florida, which is so clearly Republican Democrat, you know, whoever wins Florida normally wins the White House. It's one of those bellwether states, they call it. So, but was that the environment that you grew up in?
My mom's incredibly into politics. Yeah. Talking about Sunday mornings, she would have the news on for pretty much most of the day. She called them the talking heads, because it was, you just see their heads when they're talking. But that's what she would have on pretty much the entire morning. And it was like, oh, it's Sunday, so mom's going to have on her news, and that's all that room. So I grew up around a lot more politics than I've kept up with. When Barack Obama was first running for president, I worked on, I know, it was when he was being reelected, I think. I was working on his, like, with the Democratic Party as a way of trying to, but all I did was I was going to the high school in order to try to get people to sign up who were 18 to register to vote. And of course, people would try to be snarky and say, well, I'm going to register as Republican. I'm like, I don't care. Just register and go vote. And that's all that I care about right now. But I haven't really... Politics, to me, is so angry, especially right now. It wasn't always... It was always a little angry. But I feel like especially right now, it's just so, it's like you either, if you're not one thing, then you hate that other thing.
It was funny growing up, and I think social media's got a lot to do with that, but growing up, as I did in, you know, I remember the late 80s and certainly the 90s, when students, people my age, weren't really into politics. I mean, I suppose I went to university after something called the poll tax in this country, which was unbelievably divisive, which brought down Margaret Thatcher. But these days, people get very angry and are passionate in a way that perhaps hasn't been seen for a few decades. You know, I remember a student of mine when I was in the University of Wales did a degree in the 1960s. She said everybody went on marches, everybody was protesting about something or other. Students these days couldn't be less interested. That's all changed last few years.
Yeah, I mean, there was, when I was an undergrad, there was a lot of protesting, but it was mostly about the rise in student tuition prices, and then also the treatment of staff. Basically the students were saying, well, if you're going to, you know, charge us a lot of money, you can at least pay the staff better, which wasn't happening. I was actually commenting recently that it's quite, especially in America right now, everyone's into politics. It's a good thing, I think, in the sense that people are realizing that this stuff does affect them and their life, but it could be a little vitriolic sometimes.
Well, the worst thing, I think, is, as you say, people who didn't vote because they didn't think that their vote would make a difference.
Yeah.
And in Florida, for example, there were certainly cases, and we had it in Brexit, with the Brexit referendum in the UK a few years ago, people who thought, as a protest vote, or just to be silly, because, you know,
it's not going to happen.
They're not going to be stupid enough to vote to leave. And then they voted leave just almost as a sort of to register their, you know, to do something a little bit different, and almost as a bit of a protest vote. Then, of course, afterwards they thought, oh, actually, you know, I wouldn't have done that if I'd known it would have been this close.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Florida. I got friends and colleagues in America who feel the same thing, or in some cases they might be in Republican areas in the South, but Democrats supporting. And as you say, it's politics is sort of galvanizing people, and that's something that we would only have dreamt of 20 years ago. But in a way now that seems where the fringe candidates in many cases are getting elected, and that just isn't what was happening decades ago, when if you weren't operating in the center ground, you didn't stand much of a chance.
Yeah, it's overall a good thing that people are getting really into it, but it can sometimes be a bit bad. But the most interesting thing that happened was, so I went back to America for the last election, Trump won. And I went to my mother's church the Sunday that she goes to a Unitarian church. I was just going on because I was interested in how a Unitarian church was run. I was going purely as an academic, which was very fun, but it was overwhelmingly interesting because it was the Sunday after the election. Yeah. And everyone had this completely different reaction, and there was a woman who was crying in the pews, and it was like this really intense day. But it was very interesting to see people's differing reactions. And one person was kind of talking about how terrible anyone would be if they didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. And then another one saying, well, some of us didn't want to vote for either person. Yeah. And then you get this kind of arguing in a church that had once been talking about how wonderful and united they are.
Oh, no. I remember during the campaign on the news, we saw a woman saying, we have to vote for Trump because if Hillary is elected, she's going to ban Christmas. I see what she meant is the term Christmas. You know, happy holidays and all that. But it's interesting because I saw a poll this very morning, and I think there is one Republican candidate who's going to try and stand against Trump for the nomination. And the Republican National Committee have said he doesn't have a chance. And apparently 89% of Republicans are happy with the current president. Now, when I saw that this morning, I thought, well, hang on a minute. I remember it wasn't that long ago when some of the other candidates were refusing to endorse him, or did so very reluctantly in 2016. And he's been quite a divisive president. So that statistic intrigued me, or shocked me when I saw that this morning.
I have been told that I'm not allowed to travel to a country that has a major vote on, because I was in Scotland for that referendum. Yeah. I was here for Brexit, and then I went back to America for that election, and I was told I am not allowed to travel anymore to places that are having a vote. So, yeah.
Yeah, so you've been in all the hotspots.
I've been in the hotbed for many a year now. Yeah.
And can you remember the first time you voted in an election?
The very first year when I was 18 that I could. And I have tried to vote every year since. It's been very complicated to try to get an absentee vote sent to another country. Yeah. They tend to... It's a lot more of a difficult process than I would like. But even in the elections that aren't major ones, I try to do something.
And I agree with you. I think that people today are so... It's so good to see people casting a vote and queuing up outside ballot boxes. I'm sure in the future we'll all be doing this electronically. But it's exciting to see that happen. But at the same time, you see that perhaps the people... You know, the candidates that are being voted for, or in some cases candidates that you actually would think, I'd rather you vote than not vote at all. But, you know, if you are going to vote, really, are you going to waste that vote? Well, I say waste that vote, that person gets elected. So, yeah, it does happen. And what about things like radio? Did that ever play a role when you were growing up? I mean, for me, the soundtrack of my life has always been what's been on the radio, particularly music-based radio stations. Is that something
a
that...
A bit. When I was a lot younger, it would be, because as I said, we'd listen to the top 40 on Sundays, and it would just be on every once in a while, but it was mostly mixtapes for a while, because that's how old I am. We'd have mixtapes, then we started burning CDs to have different, when I got older, that's what it would be, and then it started being streaming. There would be a little bit of radio. I started getting into podcasts through radio, in a way, because it was all British stuff. I was quite an Anglophile when I was a lot younger, so it's nice that I'm here. There was this British radio program that was on Six Music, and they would release a podcast of basically the highlight reel of their show, and I would listen to it. And there was one year that my sister and I, she woke up very early, I stayed up the whole night in order to listen to it live. Yeah. And of course it's like, you know, on a normal Saturday morning time, but for us it was like 4 a.m. and we were still like making sure that we could listen to it live.
Yeah. That's the exciting thing about radio now, that you can access anywhere in the world through the internet.
Yeah.
And it's quite normal for someone to, a live radio program that's going out, say, in the afternoon here, and somebody will be writing in from, or, contacting the program from Florida, where it's, first thing in the morning or whatever, or indeed there might be an overnight request. And for me, that virtual community of radio, I think, is probably no less powerful now, and perhaps through podcasts as well, than it was when I was growing up. Because there was a bit of a dip. I mean, I grew up with the radio. People who were born 5 or 10 years after me, really not so much. Radio wasn't something that, when I was at university, I was unusual that I would listen to it to the degree that I did. But it's sort of making a comeback, but more through the diverse routes, as you say, when you can select those programs you want to listen to.
I think podcasts have really helped, because it's essentially radio, but just when you want to listen to it. And podcasts have come to be really a huge medium. I always felt really weird whenever students would talk to me about what I was listening to and stuff, because I'd always come in with headphones on. And I would just be listening to podcasts, and I would always be like, oh, I'm just listening to a podcast or something. And they'd be like, oh, they're listening to music or something. And then recently I started having people coming in, and they were like, oh, there's this podcast about this. And I actually had some of the students were doing research on a particular religious movement based on they listened to podcasts that were reports about it and stuff like that. So. Yeah.
So for the technology,
it's been interesting to, like, see
is moving us forward. Some more philosophically based questions as we start to wind up. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey the whole of your life?
It depends on what you mean by positive. I am someone, because I've had quite a few negative things happen to me in life, as most people who are alive have had, but I've learned to see them in the way that positive things happen. You kind of need some of the bad things in order to be able to really appreciate when good things are happening. So to me, all memories are in some way both.
Because I know one of the reasons I'm doing the nostalgia work is that very thing about, bittersweet memories, or, negative experiences where there is a challenge that's provided, and how you respond to that is something where you can walk away and say, yeah, that was a bad thing, but something good sort of came out of it. And it, so you know, originally I thought that people will just, you know, you're doing nostalgia, people just think about the happy things that happened in the past. But actually, no, I think it's the bittersweet things that give you more of a passion, and where you're not just passive spectators in the drama of life.
Yeah, it's just, I've definitely been one of those that tries to see the positive side of it. After a while, I wasn't always that way, but I just started realizing that the only person that could make me unhappy is myself, and the only person who can make me happy is myself. And so you have to just kind of confront what's going on and try to move on to it in a very positive way. And growing up, I never felt like I belonged where I was, in a lot of different senses of the word. And when I finally got here and I moved to the UK, I definitely didn't belong. I was a foreigner, and everyone knew it the minute I opened my mouth. But at least I knew I didn't belong, and everyone else knew I didn't belong. And so there was a certain comfort there. But now I've found a place where I do feel like, you know, people are comfortable with it, and I've got a partner who I can come home to, and there's, and suddenly that sense of belonging I want to hold on to so much more than I think I would have if I had always had that.
Yeah.
And so I can look back at the times where I felt kind of uncomfortable and going, well, actually, that's a good thing, because it showed me that I was uncomfortable and I needed to move somewhere else.
Yeah. And what it sounds like, yes, so being nostalgic about negative experiences, it's an odd way of phrasing it. But I think that it kind of shows that, you know, even, maybe that's why I keep a diary, you know, the times in my life when maybe I thought, oh, everything was wonderful from today's perspective, you look back and think, well, actually, there were lots of pressures and stresses and strains and the uncertainty of what life had to come. But sometimes we do kind of say, well, because it had a good ending, we might be inclined to kind of sort of, you know, park that in the positive, the optimistic box. But the actual, you know, if you were to go back to that period, you probably would think, actually, ooh, you know, oh dear, you know, it's something, or yeah, those people I avoided and blanked out of my mind are suddenly, you know, sitting right opposite me, and, you know, I've got to, you know, which is, of course, the plot of many of those films.
I try not to think of things as having an ending. So, like, my very first relationship was not a very good one, and I was very young. So I kind of saw the relationship as ended, it's ended, but in reality it kept, you know, the effects of it kept going, and the ideas behind it kept going, and it kept affecting me going forward in other relationships, and other, not just romantic ones, but in all sorts of different relationships. And it only recently kind of concluded, but it concluded in the start of a new thing. And so I try not to think of memories or ideas or eras as having an ending, but that it's constantly in flux.
Well, no, I think that's a good way of putting it. And often through social media as well, we, on a daily basis, are in touch with some of those people who geographically and chronologically are very removed from us, but they are very much in our presence sometimes.
Yeah.
Would you say that you fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young?
Yes and no. I definitely wanted to move to the UK, and I've achieved that. I didn't think I'd be here as long as I have been here, which I'm happy that I'm, at least for the time being, staying. We'll see how long it lasts, depending on visa paperwork. But
and the next election or referendum.
Yeah, we'll see. Depends on which visa works in which arena. The small things, I've achieved some of it. I've wanted to travel more than I have, but I've traveled quite a lot more than a lot of other people have been able to, so I should be happy for that. I wanted to be a writer, and I don't know whether or not, I guess I've achieved that. I've gotten a couple of things published in journal articles, and I've written a PhD, and so I should be happy that I'm a writer in that regard. But I guess my childhood version of me, imagine be sitting at coffee shops writing a fiction novel, and instead I'm sitting at a coffee shop writing up a journal article about the Slender Man. You know, it's a very different idea.
But what comes out really strongly in what you're saying is that you've got the PhD, you're proud of that, but your ambition really is to do something quite different, but which is more in keeping with perhaps what you wanted to do as that young person.
I see the PhD as a stepping point. It's not an end point. Which I should probably be happy for what I've accomplished. It's coming across as like I'm not happy with having the PhD. I'm very happy with having the PhD, but I see it as a necessary point in order to do the next thing. And if it's an academic job and writing, then that's great. But if it's not, then at least I can prove that what I'm doing is academically sound, even if it's not being funded through a university department.
Yeah. And would you say finally that you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm a looking forward kind of person. I remember a lot of the past, and I try to make it dictate how I act moving forward, but I try to use it always as a learning experience. It's always a thing of, well, now I know how that works. Now I know what to do in future situations. I wasn't always that way, but I'm that way now, and I think it's the best way to be, because it just makes things not so hard.
Vivian, it has been such a delight to catch up with you again and to turn the tables on you.
Oh, thank you for having me.